typically are for Dodger, Joe. You've got yourself out of trouble there.
Let's not go over that and have the same row that we had 3-4 months ago when ultimately I was right, Joe.
I mean, you've just confessed to being wrong.
OTB AM, weekdays from 7:30 AM. Listen on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
Now, very happy to say we're joined by, once upon a time, quite a regular guest on the show, a bit less so now. He is the former Connacht coach, now director of rugby with Bristol there for the past 3, going on 4 years. Bristol, 8 points clear of Exeter. They're top of the Premiership after 19 games. I'm, of course, talking about Pat Lamb. Pat, good to talk to you. How are things?
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Joe. Joe Gooch.
Well, indeed. Well, listen, good. You're keeping it up, are you?
Oh, yeah. We've got a few Irish boys here and a wonderful time. It's bits and pieces I won't forget, you know, for the rest of my life. It was a great time.
You popped into my head over the weekend because the Heineken Champions Cup final was on at Twickenham, and Heineken Cup final, Twickenham always means Munster, Northampton back in 2000. Bad day for Munster, good day for you. 21 years ago, where did that go?
I know, it's amazing. There's a lot of banter. A few of the players and coaches were showing me the images that were going up, and they said, geez, you're skinny here and you're a lot younger. And I said, well, time flies, you know, but still young at heart.
What are your big memories of that day?
I knew that we were massive underdogs because we were fighting on three fronts on those days. And in those days, they didn't have, dedicated weeks. So if you're the more successful you are, you ended up playing premiership games midweek. And it's probably where I started all my injuries eventually, because I pretty much played every game. And I was due when I did my shoulder earlier. I was due for some surgery, and there's a lot of us that were pretty broken. We hadn't trained, but I remember we went out for training that week, and I remember saying to the guys, I could just see it wasn't happening. And I said, look, do we really need to do the scrums? Yeah, how many scrums have we hit? I mean, it was Freddie Mendez at the time. I said, how many scrums have we hit this year? And I said, so do we really need it, or can we make it happen? And we were really light on our training, but we were right for the kickoff. We knew that if we came up against Munster, they had an unbelievable game against Toulouse. Mm. Let's say, and I know it looked like that we were, a lot of the media put us down and out because of the injuries, because of what we've been through. But I remember saying, if we can hit them hard early, go hard early in the first 20 and shock them and hang in there. And that's exactly what we did. It wasn't a 9-8, wasn't the greatest in that sense, and it wasn't the greatest game. Yeah. But for where Northampton had come from, what they hadn't achieved, it was massive and a nice highlight.
Do you miss your playing days, Pat?
No, I don't actually, because I treasured every moment of it. I think I'm blessed in that I'm still involved in the game. But I had a wonderful career, a lot of opportunities, played great rugby, played rubbish rugby, experienced it all. Half of my career was in as a school teacher, the amateur days, playing purely for love, traveling away on 6-8 week tours, coming back, going back to school teaching, having to train in the morning, train in the evenings, not much time with the young kids. To them, professional, and then all the time with the kids, getting paid for something that you love to do. And I always think that we were the lucky ones to do both, rather than come straight into rugby and getting paid for it, because we truly, truly paid for the love of the game. And I'm not saying that players today don't, but it helped me recognize that professionalism certainly has nothing at all to do with money. It is the way you do things. And I don't miss the playing days at all, but I certainly have great memories from them.
You used the phrase there, I treasured every moment. What a great thing to be able to say. Is that something that you actively work on? Or are you just that way inclined anyway? Or are you trying to stop and smell the roses a little bit in life?
Yeah, I mean, the older you get, the more you reflect, everything seems, better. You look back and you go, but it was funny because I think some of the guys said, geez, your breakdown technique. And I said, well, funny enough, we never had no breakdown technique coaches. You were just told to smash rucks, okay, just hit it as hard as you can, no detail. In fact, what I did love about playing in the Northern Hemisphere, Dean Ryan and Rob Andrew brought me up to Newcastle. And he said to me, look, the way you play, you don't have to hit rucks. There's a lot of guys hit rucks. You just get in amongst the backs. And okay. I remember I ended up scoring a lot of tries. I think someone sent me Newcastle. Someone in Newcastle talked about all the history of Newcastle. And I think I scored a lot of tries. And people literally said, you hang out on the wing. And I said, yeah, I did, because I was given the license, just play in the backs. And it was great. It was really enjoyable. And probably being able with professionalism go to different teams. I think one of the things I've done, you know, when I look into my coaching now too, is that when you played in the amateur day, similar to the Gaelic games, you play for your school, you play for your province or your county, and you play for your country, nothing else. So loyalty and all that was easy because you know, but the moment professionalism came and you moved because it became a job and you traveled. But ultimately, you know, what you're trying to do and the reason why you connect with the team that you play for, because you can't, in those days, you know, if I'm from Galway, I can't talk to a Mayo person and say, come on, you got to play for Galway. But what you can do is, or from Connacht, I can't get a Dublin guy say, man, it's all about Galway and the west of Ireland. But what you can do is connect them to the people from there and the kids from there and the community from there. Because for me as a player, when I went to Newcastle, it was the first time I moved to, well, Crusaders, and then to Northampton, I needed to connect. That's why I got in the community, to meet the people and see what it means to them. So I knew 5 minutes from the end, we're desperate to win or we have to put the bodies on the line. I knew what it was for these people. And that's what sort of why with Connacht, with Bristol, connecting the players to, you know, what the team is about is an important part of, I believe, what we do.
One last one on your playing days. I do want to talk to you about how the season's going, and it's going very well for you, but it just, the way you talk there, things like passion and loyalty and all these, you know, very powerful emotions. What was your proudest day as a player? I don't mean necessarily most successful, but a proud day for you as a player, and why?
91 World Cup. We beat Wales. Massive. Obviously, people talk about it now, but I think it wasn't just the game. Obviously, it was a big game, but what it did for Samoan people. I mean, at that stage in the 90s, I'd come through, you know, New Zealand at that stage as well, and since I've been born and brought up in New Zealand. But Pacific Islanders were seen as the factory workers, the lower class, and so forth. And I knew it because I was a school teacher. And a lot of Pacific Island kids. And after doing that, it made not only Samoan people, but Pacific Island people extremely proud. And I could see it in, you know, even young kids saying that, Mr. Lamb, I'm going to play for Manu Samoa now growing up. And people could put their shoulders back and say, I'm born. You know, and I know in the 80s, 90s, it wasn't necessarily particularly 80s and 70s. They had dawn raids. They had all of those days back in New Zealand. So that was a proud moment that specific people got extremely proud of what happened there. And through the 90s, certainly, Samoan rugby was we were right up there. So that's what we did there was special.
Yeah, no doubt.
But I think before then we had only had Wales was the only Tier 1 country that invited us to play an international. If you have a look after that 91, All Blacks, Australia, we started getting all these invitations that opened the doorway to for Samoan rugby.
And actually, a connected point to that, here we are in 2021, and you know, the last couple of years in rugby, there's been so much talk about the international game and how it should be formatted and who should play where and when. Do the Pacific Island nations get a voice in all this? Are they largely ignored? Is there a kind of cozy cabal looking after the Tier 1 guys? What's your sense of that?
I think that's been the big thing, is around the voice and making sure that there is a bigger voice for the Pacific Islands. I think when you look at the percentage of Pacific Island Polynesian players playing the game at the highest level around all the competitions, influence and all the, I mean, who would have thought, you know, the UK teams and Irish teams have any Pacific Island influence. But that's the nature of, of South Sea Islanders. They travel and they, I mean, it's amazing how many Polynesians I've run into in remote places of the world. They're everywhere. Mm. But it's, you know, it certainly a representation would be a better representation. But I think most importantly, back in the islands, I always talk about the governance. It's like anything. You've got to change the governance. You got to ensure that, you know, you can give as much money, but what is the structures like? And the same when I've come here. I mean, at the moment, I'm in the process of realigning the Bears woman. They were out here. The academy was out here, but changing the governance to bring them all aligned, then we can actually do make genuine improvement, yeah, and put structures in place that outlive all of us that are going to go and come and go, put it in place. And similar to what we're doing at Connacht, put things in place that anyone leaves, the next person comes in, they understand what we're about and what we do.
Mm. So, director of rugby at Bristol, 2018 promotion, 2019 you finished ninth in the table, 2020 third, lost an away semi-final to Wasps, and also won the Challenge Cup, and as of this year, top with a few games to go. Happy?
Happy, but not satisfied. I think we're on, I put together a five-year plan, and we've ticked to our third year. The first year didn't count, because when I made the plan for Steve Lansdowne and Chris Boy, I signed in December, I think 2016, and they were in the premiership. By the time I arrived at June, they'd been relegated. So the first year was about getting back up, which was good. And then we started the plan. But every year, set the goal higher, the bottom line. And, you know, 3 years now in the premiership, we've ticked all of those goals. And the reason why I did it is because I wanted to ensure that we were improving areas and not getting comfortable. And so, yeah, we're tracking nicely. But as I said, the boys know and the staff know complacency will kill us. And, you know, it's about pushing the next, raise the level, everyone raise the performance. And if we keep doing that, we keep growing.
Mm. How are you changing as a coach? Would say the... some of the Connacht boys, if they were to see you in action now in 2021, would they notice a difference in how you are?
I'm older. I got a beard. I think fundamentally, because I gave all the Connacht players and all the Bristol players and all the Bristol and Connacht staff my coaching philosophy. And the reason why I give them exactly my coaching, why I coach, is because they have real clarity as what I am. And more importantly, they can keep me accountable to it. So the fact that I haven't changed my coaching philosophy from Connacht to Bristol, you know, is because what I've changed is my experiences of meeting people. You know, like I'm just meeting new people, but fundamentally, the way I do things around relationships, around building community, around guys connecting people, very, very similar. The game is very similar in the sense that it's a team game. I know people always argument about structure. To me, structure is around, no, on the same page. So if me and you are on the same team, Joe, you know, one word, we both know what we mean. It's the language. It's like, you know, I can say Jiragwich here, and people, a lot of people here might not know what I'm talking about, but the Connacht boys know. It's just getting the language and people on the same page, because it's a team job. I don't want, yes, we have Semi Radradra and Charles Piertel, but they've played less than 50% of the games here, because it doesn't matter if Semi's not here. Pierce O'Connor steps up, who came through the championship. He's got the same requirement to do that Semi has. And likewise, Johan Lloyd, who was in our academy, steps up, plays fullback when Charles is not there. He has the same requirement to do it. And, you know, so everything is around making sure it's a true team game. And that's why Connacht is without doubt my coaching highlight, because we didn't have the budget. We didn't have, you know, as resources as our competitors. But the system is the same. And it was a true team effort. And what I'm doing out here at Bristol is exactly the same. Right. But obviously the budget and resources are different. But yes, the formula is the same.
And so with Connacht, for all those, you know, you mentioned those various characteristics, I suppose, of Connacht, geographically, economically, all that kind of stuff. There was a ready-made identity there almost. How does Bristol compare?
In which sense? You mean in
the... Even just the town and the area, and like what kind of things are you feeding into? Because at Connacht, you did it so naturally. I mean, it was organic, it was real, and you know, feeling like the forgotten province, there was a bit of that in it. And Bristol, obviously, a very different project and well-funded. So what are you trying to get into in the Bristol area and with the team?
I think if you look at the history of Bristol was the key. I put up the last 10 years of Bristol rugby. And I could have gone further. And I put down all where they ended up, the team ended up. And there was like 10 of those years, eight of those years were in the championship. And I just put it up to everybody. And I said, well, what does everyone think here? And they said, not great. Change needs to happen. I said, excellent. Because I said, there's going to be change to come. Not everything, because there's been some really good things. But the most important thing we needed to do was understand the vision and where we want to go to. I think Bristol... So they knew, and part of the reason when, you know, they sold me when I was coming here was that it was told as a sleeping giant. They were struggling. They needed success. They needed to inspire the, you know, the community. They wanted, you know, there was a real rugby hub, because in the 80s and 70s, Bristol was one of the big areas of rugby in England, but they just haven't been there. So that was great. And then connecting, as far as the community, he goes, connecting to the actual community and to the schools, and by us being more successful, you know, whether it's at realigning the academy, getting the guys out into the clubs, getting guys, a lot of very similar stuff that we did at Connacht. Suddenly players got connected, community got connected, and all of a sudden people are going, well, these guys are real. And I said, well, they signed up to it, you know.
What I always remember most strongly, I suppose, from your Connacht days is the way you went about improving skill sets. And we're talking here about players in their mid-20s, late-20s, who I think would have been of the opinion probably that I'm fully formed now. This is just who I am. And before they knew it, they were taking a rugby ball home with them because their coach was making them do it. And we saw it come to fruition. So similar mindsets to change at Bristol? Are you seeing guys in, you know, props in their 20s that need to be told, yeah, you're going to have to start passing the ball? Because I think it's probably the great failing of professional sport at a certain level that we just think, well, that's your ceiling hit now. That is your skill set for the next 10 years of your career.
Now, again, part of my on-field philosophy is there's your positional skills, but then there's team skills. Doesn't matter what number you have on your jersey and things you need to get done. I think you just have to look at someone like Dave Atwood, played for England, Bath many years. On against Gloucester last week, if you look at the non-try that Kyle Sinclair got, he carried the ball and Gloucester flew up on the outside and he used a bit of footwork, and Dave doesn't normally have footwork, but he offloaded to Simi Radradra, who then offloaded to Max Malins, to Ben Earl, and then Kyle Sinclair came. But you go bring it right back, Dave Atwood, you know. And one of the things I love is when the front rollers in the tight five are saying to me, I've never been asked to pass this ball this many times, and the amount of passing they do. We have skill sessions here. It's about four times a week. Guys sign up for them. Normally go at 7:30, 7:45, and 8 o'clock. The first one is static. The second one is walking. And the third one is jogging. So closed skills where they improve, whether it's passing, decision-making, peripheral. And because they know the toolbox has to keep growing, Semi Radradra is doing the skills as well. Charles Pietel does the skills. It just becomes a culture of improvement. And because of the game that I want, as I said, I never want to bring the game down to the level of the players. The players need to come up to the level of the game that I want, which means the quality of the coaching needs to, and the staff needs to, and that's where the magic happens, as I said many times. So that's what I mean, the similarities of what at Connacht and Bristol is the same. You know, just the players are different, but the requirement is the same.
It's such an interesting thing to hear. And it makes such sense to listen to you talk this way, because so often, I mean, to use a high profile example, and I'm not inviting you to create a headline here or anything, but Jose Mourinho, to use, you know, somebody who's achieved great things. I don't know how closely you follow football, but even recently when he's departing at Spurs, he's doing his interview saying players aren't good enough, you know, and he's being asked, how come you had great success a couple of years ago and you're not having it now? And he said, same manager, different players, as in, I'm as good, they're not as good, kind of thing. And that mindset is coming from like one of the great coaches in the world, kind of extraordinary.
I use this, and the coaches know this. The magic happens, and this is what I look for in players. And remember, I didn't know many of the Connacht players. I didn't know many of the Bristol boys when I first arrived there. But I don't look at them. I'm looking for coachable. Big dreams, highly motivated by big dreams, coachable. If I've got that, and then I get quality staff, bring them together, that's where the magic happens. So if a coach turns around to me, so Connor McPhillips says to me, oh, he can't do that. He's not good enough. The issue's with Connor. The issue's with the coach.
Right.
However, if I know that Connor's doing everything and his skill set, which is great, to improve this player, but I've got a player who goes, I do it this way, or I know he hasn't put the work in, the issue's with the player. But the magic happens when he's hungry and motivated and I've got great staff, boom, away we go. And that's what I believe happened in Connacht. Great. And my role is to ensure the program is really good, but I need the coachable, motivated players. And it doesn't matter what you've achieved. It's about the here and the now. And that's why I love Kyle Sinclair as one of the, you know, massive about wanting to improve. I've got John Ofoa, you know, 37, out there, skill set, and still trying to improve. Semi Radradra, you know, and you got Callum Sheedy, you know, who was fourth choice when he was here in the academy. Whew, how did he get there? You know, is because highly motivated, believed he wants to play for England. I get asked all the time, well, Pat, which player is going to, you know, play for, names, couple they're going to play for England. All those who are English qualified will play for England if they do the work.
Mm.
It's over to them.
How do you handle a situation like Kyle Sinclair post Lions? Everybody saw his emotional interview afterwards. I mean, do you give him extra love and attention or let him figure out on his own over the last couple of weeks? What's your approach there?
Well, our culture is very similar to Connacht, is love. You know, sacrifice oneself for the benefit of us. All the boys know that. Very tough situation because everyone thought he was a sitter. We're having our team meeting, team review, and we knew that the time was there. And I asked the media guy, just send me the message when the team's name, just when Kyle's done, then I can announce it and then we can go out and train. I got the message about 10 minutes before the end. I could see it yet, and they said Sink's missed out. So we just finished the meeting, went out, and obviously you can see the boys look at the phones and everyone realised the bombshell. But also I went down, got my stuff. By the time I got on the field, Kyle's already warming up and he just gave him a hug and he said, mate, all good, I'm going to use this for good. And he just got on with it. He trained superbly that day, sent out a classy tweet about it, and then played a man of the match against Bath, and it's just gone on. You know, he's, you know, from a distance, you know, people have opinions of players, and I had the same with Irish players and stuff. And it's like when I played, I didn't like players because they're on the opposite team or the you know, whether they're in the, you know, the Canterbury team or whether they were Leinster players and we're kind of, but you get to know people completely different. And, and you know, people's actions when you get to know them is what is impressive.
Yeah, look, life has its disappointments, doesn't it? That's the reality.
What makes the great players, the disappointments and the bounce back.
How is your forwards coach, young John Muldoon, getting on?
Oh, mate, honestly, really proud of them. I mean, you look at our forward pack, look at the stats, people dig a bit deeper. We're the only team to concede only one, well, it was a penalty try that we gave against Quins that, you know, so we haven't actually conceded a more try. I mean, you think about how many teams, you look at all the teams, Leicester's, the more, you know, for us to do that. And then we've also got the most more tries. That's right. John Muldoon. I think you look at our forward pack and the way they're going, John's done a great job. He's transitioned seamlessly. Firstly, I brought him through to defence, which is great because he built relationship with the whole squad. And now he's doing his forward. So, you know, the plan is with John, similar to, is to, you know, to grow him. And eventually I think he'll be a fantastic head coach. And the same with Connor McPhillips. Connor's done a great job, you know, from, you know, the guy that I wanted to get rid of when I first arrived because he was analysis. And I wanted to bring mine from the Blues, Super Rugby, but realised we didn't have the budget and I had to keep him. And everyone was on his contract. Quickly realised the quality and his, you know, and his desire to be a coach, bring him into the coaching group. And, you know, he's a big, both of them are massive assets for me.
In broad terms, I mean, you're away from home, quote-unquote home, I guess, you know, New Zealand for a long time now, and I'm sure that has a pull and there are things you sacrifice by not being at home. What are the big sacrifices and do you have ultimately a plan to get back there before too long?
Well, like to me, home is where my family are. You know, okay. Like I've always said that, like obviously the biggest thing with technology was FaceTime and Zoom and with my parents, that's my main concern, you know, but the issue up here is the holidays of July, and July I'm not great in the cold. I love the summer. So mum and dad would always come up. COVID they haven't. So my three boys now are back in New Zealand. My two girls are here. in Bristol. And but I think, I mean, I'm loving it up here. Like, as the, like my yesterday was my fourth child's 21st birthday, so I've grown mass fast. And you know, it's easy to get back, but, you know, I love the job. It's a real passion. So I just feel blessed in what I'm doing. You know, I actually don't even see it as a job. You know,